This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 28, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, it's the third day of the Supreme Court hearing on health care reform. Justices examined what parts of the law would be allowed to stand if the individual mandate is ruled unconstitutional. As scientists release new findings on the extent of climate change and extreme weather, the threat to coastal communities grows. And we'll go to Pakistan, where Pashtun women face challenges in getting ID cards necessary for voting, travel, and getting benefits. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In Mali today, thousands of people were in the streets showing their support for the coup government that seized power last week. African leaders are scheduled to travel to the country within the next 48 hours to attempt to mediate the situation. FSRN's Amadou Tembine reports from the capital.
Protesters are calling on African leaders and the international community not to impose sanctions against the new regime, while government soldiers are fighting with Tuareg rebel groups in the north of the country. Tuesday night, military leaders announced a new constitution. Captain Amadou Sanogo, the joint leader who declared himself interim president, has promised to hand over power to civilians, but he did not specify when a presidential election will take place. Under the new constitution, none of the members of the transitional government will be allowed to run for parliamentary and presidential elections. Amadou Tembine, FSRN, Bamako.
New tests of the damaged number 2 reactor at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant show radiation readings remain well above fatal levels, and there is very little cooling water inside, despite efforts to pump more into the reactor. The water level is currently only 6% of what officials said it was late last year, when the government said the plant was stable, according to the AP. Conditions in the other two damaged reactors could be worse, but plant operators have not been able to take measurements there. Continued protests from Tibetan exiles greeted Chinese President Hu Jintao as he arrived in New Delhi today for the BRICS Economic Summit. FSRN's Bismillah Gilani has this update.
Tibetan refugees expressed their anger throughout the day, staging about half a dozen demonstrations across Delhi. The police arrested nearly 50 refugees as they tried to force their way into the hotel where President Hu Jintao was staying. More than 100 others were arrested at an anti-China demonstration outside the United Nations office. The refugees also submitted a memorandum to the embassies of Brazil, Russia, and South Africa, the other members of the BRICS group, urging them to take up the issues of human rights violations in Tibet. Sevang Dolma is coordinator of the Tibetan Youth Congress.
This protest, we're not against any, whatever the meeting is going on, it's regarding this economic thing. We're not doing a protest against that. So we want in the meeting to talk about what's going on inside Tibet.
Meanwhile, the 27-year-old refugee who set himself on fire in protest earlier this week died in a hospital today. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
In other news from India, following day-long violent clashes, strikes, and protest rallies all over the country, the Indian government has stayed the execution of a man convicted of terrorism. Balwant Singh Rajawana was sentenced to death by hanging for the assassination of a chief minister of Punjab state in 1995. If Saturday's hanging was allowed to go forward, it would have been the first execution in India since 2004. FSRN's Prabhakar Mani Tewari reports.
A court in Punjab state ruled on Tuesday that Rajawana should be hanged as scheduled on March 31. In response, radical Sikh groups called a statewide strike. The protests threw normal life out of gear, forcing schools and shops to shut down. The demonstrations turned violent in many parts of the country, including Jammu and Kashmir, injuring more than a dozen people. Several Punjab ministers also delivered clemency petitions to the government, prompting the government's reversal of decision today. According to Amnesty International, Indian courts continue to impose the death penalty, but no official executions have been carried out during last 8 years. The Human Rights Group sent an open letter to Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh on Monday, urging an official moratorium on all executions. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN, Kolkata.
Several dozen people protested outside the Jamaican Security Ministry Tuesday, calling for a halt to police killings. About 50 people have been killed by island police this year, 27 this month alone, according to local media. In one controversial instance earlier this month, 6 civilians, including a young girl and 2 senior citizens, were killed during an alleged shootout between police and gunmen. Protester Carol Narcisse with the Jamaican Civil Society Coalition spoke to the Jamaica Gleaner.
Killings in unquestionable circumstance are a daily occurrence almost in Jamaica. But this many in the space of 1 month either suggests that there is a growing sense of impunity in the police force, or perhaps, and maybe in addition, the level of fear amongst police officers such that you act out of the fear rather than considering what the force orders say you are supposed to do.
Narcisse said a big problem is that the country's laws governing police protocols, so-called force orders, aren't being enforced. Protesters were greeted by several heavily armed police officers who monitored the demonstration. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Fort Smith, Arkansas, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. On the third and final day of Supreme Court hearings on the Affordable Care Act, the justices debated how much of the law can still stand if the individual mandate is ruled unconstitutional. While the lawyer for the National Federation of Independent Business argued for tossing out the entire act and giving Congress, quote, a clean slate, the Justice Department says the remaining provisions advance the goal of providing affordable care and the court should uphold them. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the story in Washington, D.C.
Many different legal reforms were passed under the umbrella of the Affordable Care Act, but most legal challenges have been aimed at the individual mandate, which requires that most uninsured Americans either purchase a health care plan or pay a penalty, starting in 2014. Attorney Paul Clement, arguing for the National Federation of Independent Businesses, said the mandate is so closely tied to the other pieces that a ruling against the mandate should kill the bill as a whole.
The provisions that have constitutional difficulties or are tied at the hip to those provisions that have the constitutional difficulty are the very heart of this act. And then if you look at how they are textually interconnected with the exchanges, which are then connected to the tax credits, which are also connected to the employer mandates, which is also connected to some of the revenue offsets, which is also connected to Medicaid, if you follow that through, what you end up with at the end of that process is just sort of a hollow shell.
Clement urged the court to throw out all 2,700 pages of the act. But Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg disagreed and criticized what she called Clement's wrecking ball approach.
Mr. Clement, there are so many things in this act that are unquestionably okay. I think you would concede that reauthorizing, what is it, the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, changes to the Black Lung Benefits, why may Congress redo those? It's a choice between a wrecking operation, which is what you are requesting, or a salvage job. And the more conservative approach would be salvage rather than throwing out everything.
At the heart of Wednesday's arguments was the question of what standard the court should use when deciding which parts of the law can survive without the mandate. Some argued for the standard of congressional intent, asking, would Congress have passed this or that part of the bill without the mandate? Others argued for a different standard, asking, do these remaining parts of the Affordable Care Act advance the overall goal of affordable care? Attorney Edwin Needler argued on behalf of the federal government that they do.
The notion that Congress would have intended the whole act to fall if there couldn't be a minimum coverage provision is refuted by the fact that there are many, many provisions of this act already in effect without a minimum coverage provision.
Needler cited the rule allowing millions of young adults to stay on their parents' insurance plans until age 26, and the measures bringing down the cost of prescription drugs, which he says are already benefiting millions of Americans. But he did concede that certain provisions are too tied to the individual mandate to survive without it, including the prohibition on denying coverage due to pre-existing conditions or medical history. A few hours later, the justices reconvened to hear a challenge to another piece of the Affordable Care Act, the expansion of Medicaid. Clement argued that the provision forcing states to accept more people into the Medicaid program violates states' rights, even though the federal government will fund it. Before the hearing, doctors, patients, caregivers, and advocates spoke on the Supreme Court's steps about what Medicaid means to them and why they support the expansion. Among them were Linda and Eric Christensen of Arlington, Virginia, who suddenly got custody of their very sick granddaughter and turned to Medicaid when they couldn't properly care for her.
There were doctor's visits, tests, x-rays, EKGs, ultrasounds, many medical expenses. Our retirement income would not have been enough to pay for all the care she needed.
The Christensens concluded their comments with an idea expressed by many speakers from both sides of the debate, that behind all the technical legal arguments inside the court over the last 3 days is the question of what kind of country the U.S. wants to be.
Having had this experience, we are appalled and frightened that anyone, much less our government, would ever even think about taking away that safety net.
I think that the founding fathers would like to be proud of the way America cares.
Just across the street from the Supreme Court, the House of Representatives took up Congressmember Paul Ryan's budget, which would cut Medicaid spending by more than $800 billion over a decade. A vote could come as soon as Thursday. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Today on the floor of Congress, Representative Bobby Rush of Illinois called for an investigation into the killing of unarmed teen Trayvon Martin.
Just because someone wears a hoodie does not make them a hoodlum.
But Representative Greg Harper, who was presiding over the floor, interrupted Rush when Rush removed his jacket and revealed a hoodie he was wearing. He pulled the hood up and put sunglasses on, calling for an end to racial profiling. Rush was escorted from the House floor. Yesterday, Representative Rush was one of the lawmakers that heard testimony from Martin's parents, including his mother, Sabrina Fulton.
Trayvon was our son, but Trayvon is your son.
That's right.
A lot of people can relate to our situation, and it breaks their heart just like it breaks mine.
The Florida teen's killer, George Zimmerman, has yet to be arrested. Also in the Capitol, the House and Senate came together to approve a bill called the Jobs Act that's now on its way to the president's desk, where it's expected to be signed into law. But some say the act weakens regulation on businesses and exposes investors to new financial risks. FSRN's Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
The Jobs Act is six bills wrapped into one. It will ease some regulations and is intended to help small businesses access capital. Virginia Republican Congressperson Rob Whitman says it's important that lawmakers can agree on legislation to help businesses.
I think it's significant. I think anything that we can do up here to help with the creation of jobs, to help spur this economy along, we ought to be doing it.
Another supporter, Illinois Republican Congressperson Judy Biggert, says the legislation is all about clearing red tape for startups.
We've seen it time and time again in the face of foreign crises, natural disaster, or fiscal adversity. American entrepreneurs and job creators never stop innovating. But to harness that power and the jobs that come with it, we need to clear a path for the startups and fledgling businesses that bring new goods and ideas into the marketplace. That's the purpose of H.R. 3606, the Jumpstart Our Business Startups, or Jobs Act.
Even though the bill has broad bipartisan support, attracting 380 supporters in the House alone, Democrats say it's partly a political move by Republican leaders who don't want to look like obstructionists. Virginia Democratic Congressperson Jerry Connolly says it's been a long time coming.
I'm glad we're even having the discussion. It's taken over a year for the Republican majority to get around to this.
The Jobs Act is intended to help small businesses form capital by undoing some federal regulations. But the Securities and Exchange Commission says such a move opens up too many people to fraud. Maryland Democratic Senator Barbara Mikulski agrees.
I feel that it is another scheme that will, under the guise of promoting capital formation, that it is another scheme to bilk small investors.
Lawmakers in both chambers weren't able to offer many amendments to drastically alter the original House version of the bill. Maryland Democratic Senator Ben Cardin is on the Small Business Committee and opposed the Jobs Act. He says it was disappointing that he and other members of the business committee weren't allowed to offer their amendments.
We still need to do a better job on credit for small businesses. We've talked about that. We have some programs. We'd like to see that more effectively used. We've made a lot of advancements in government procurement. We still could do better on preventing the bundling that hurts small companies from getting government contracts.
Some experts say the Jobs Act isn't likely to spur job growth immediately. And another measure to increase employment, the transportation bill, is currently stalled. Maryland Democratic Congressperson John Sarbanes says Congress ought to be investing in infrastructure projects and looking at changing the tax code.
But you got to kind of get past this mentality that you can't spend any money at all. And you also got to get past the notion that we can't go ask those who've done the best in this country to contribute a little bit more.
While the Jobs Act doesn't have everything the two parties want, Congressman Whitman says it's a step in the right direction.
I hope that we don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and we ought to make sure we're getting these things done, even if it's an incremental process.
The Jobs Act is now in the hands of President Obama, who is expected to sign it. As for the transportation bill, it's still unclear if the two parties can come together and extend the program. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Global climate change is already causing extreme weather, such as heat waves and flooding, according to a scientific study out this week. The study from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Change in Germany finds that lines of evidence strongly indicate that droughts and heavy rainfall will also increase in the years to come. Today, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change also released a report that draws on authors from more than 60 countries. It finds that human influence has likely caused extreme daily temperatures at the global scale and that there has been significant trends in heavy rainfall in some regions. This month, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development said that greenhouse gas emissions are set to rise 50% by 2050 worldwide if energy and climate policies don't change. That could mean problems for coastal communities as sea levels are projected to rise. Two studies from the group Climate Central say more than 2,000 towns and cities along U.S. coasts, or nearly 4 million people, could be hit by sea level rise. For more details, we're joined by Ben Strauss, co-author of the reports published in the journal Environmental Research Letters. He's also director of the program on sea level rise at the group Climate Central. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you, Dorian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your study estimates a 1 meter rise in high tide. That's almost 3.5 feet. That rise could affect 3.7 million people in the U.S. Where are these communities located?
Yes, at the 1 meter level, the largest concentration of vulnerable people is in Florida. But we also found pockets of vulnerability all around the lower 48 states. Louisiana, the New Orleans area is highly vulnerable. New York City and Long Island, as well as the Jersey Shore. The Chesapeake part of Virginia. Charleston, South Carolina. The Bay Area of California, and to our surprise as well, Southern California in the Los Angeles area. We found pockets of vulnerability really almost anywhere we looked.
And when you talk about vulnerability, what kind of a change are we talking about? What kind of possible damage or threats are part of this?
Well, what we did was we analyzed local projections of sea level rise in combination with storm surges and tides. You might think of it simply a little like raising the floor of a basketball court. If you were to do that, there would be a lot more dunks. So sea level rise raises the launch pad for coastal storms and storm surges. And really, we've already seen 8 inches of sea level rise from global warming over the last century.
You mentioned Florida as one of the places that in your study is identified as particularly vulnerable. To get specific about a certain area, how would communities be affected by this sea level rise there? There are, of course, high-density population areas in along the coasts of both coasts of Florida.
Yes. So, for example, within 4 feet of the high tide line, we found about 5 million people vulnerable, or 5 million people living less than 4 feet above high tide nationwide, and 2.4 million out of those 5 million are in Florida, almost half. Florida has a couple of special additional problems. One of those special problems is that the bedrock for much of Florida, including the southeast, where most people are exposed, the Miami-Dade and Broward County areas, the bedrock is porous. It's a little like Swiss cheese. Water comes up through it. It can come up through the ground. So you can't build a seawall to permanently or effectively protect South Florida. The second big problem for Florida, special problem, is it's an area prone to summer downpours, and there's a big need for draining fresh water, storm water, off the land and into the ocean. There's an extensive network of engineered canals in southern Florida designed to do that, and we project 6 inches of sea level rise as being very feasible within just the next 2 decades.
These studies are a projection of what's to come in the coming years. What can be done now to either stop this from happening or mitigate the damage done by rising sea level?
Yeah. Well, one strategy is to cut heat-trapping pollution, reduce our emissions from burning fossil fuel and other sources, and that can slow down the rate of sea level rise and the total amount. But there's a lot of sea level rise that's already baked in the cake that's going to be inevitable. So to defend the people who live, who are most vulnerable and who live in the most vulnerable places, I think the first line of defense is natural and soft defenses where they exist and are available. Beaches and coastal marshes provide a buffer against storms. And so to reduce the damage, we need to protect the beaches and marshes that we have and leave them room to migrate where that's possible, because they're going to want to migrate inland as the sea level rises. The other alternative would be to wait for the big flood, and that would hurt a lot more.
Ben Strauss is director of the Program on Sea Level Rise at Climate Central. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
And you can look up your own community by zip code and get information on the impact of climate change and sea level rise on the website surgingseas.org. You can also find that link and more information on the study on our website, fsrn.org. Located on the southern seaboard of Pakistan, Karachi is the country's most populous city. Although modern and a hub of education, industry, and the arts, Karachi's female Pashtun population faces many of the same inequalities as women who live in the tribal areas. One big challenge is obtaining identity cards, which enable women to vote and to register for government benefits. FSRN's Catherine Comp reads for our reporter in Pakistan, Gabe Matthews.
Down a narrow, dirty street in Karachi stand several old 5- and 6-story apartment buildings. On the streets near the buildings, not one woman can be seen. Because of cultural restrictions, Pashtun women rarely go outside. Inside these apartment buildings live hundreds of low-income Pashtun people, many of whom have been here for decades. On the fourth floor of one of the buildings, a young girl, covering her face, opens the door. Inside is a small apartment consisting of 2 rooms and a kitchen. This is the home of 45-year-old Mumtaz Begum, a social and political worker who advocates for Pashtun women's rights in Karachi. She invites Pashtun women to her apartment daily to discuss their problems. Begum says one of the most challenging issues for women is obtaining identity cards.
Nobody cares about women's identity cards. If women come to the identity card office, men push them. Men only seek identity cards for women for their own benefit, to obtain a piece of land, or if they have some financial loss. When men urgently need a woman to get an ID for their own benefit, they bribe government officials with large amounts of money.
One of the women who came to today's session is 20-year-old Gulnar Begum, originally from Sawat. She doesn't have an identity card, but questions what she'd even do with one when she is confined to her house.
My father and brother do not want me to go out of the house, but we'd like to go out of the house with mother, even if my father and brother do not allow us to go out alone. They want us to remain inside the house and work for them all day long. House is like a jail for us.
Gulnar Begum says if she had an identity card, she might be able to travel back to Swat, where the military checks people's IDs. She also says she might learn more if she could leave the house and meet people.
We do not know if we talk right and polite or not. We only know how people talk in the home, and we can only talk about home.
Another woman here is Jamal Bibi, a mother of 11 children who has an expired identity card. Her entire life consists of caring for the children and the house, and fending off attacks by her husband.
My husband does not allow us to go out of the house. He beats me when I go out of the house. My husband is cruel because he does not allow me to have my identity card. An identity card is very important these days. I cannot go out of the house, nor can I let my daughters go out of the house. My husband beats me and other people create hurdles for me when I ask for my rights. I am very helpless.
Karachi is a financial capital of Pakistan. Many Pashtuns migrated here following the recent military operations in Swat and the tribal areas, and they now make up the second largest ethnic community in the city. The lifestyle of Pashtun men has changed dramatically, as there are more job and educational opportunities in Karachi. But Pashtun women live with centuries-old customs, which are restrictive and oppressive. At the National Database and Registration Authority office, 25-year-old Dayud Khan waits to renew his identity card. The auto rickshaw driver has 12 females in his family, and he proudly says that none of them have an ID.
We do not allow our women to have identity cards because then everybody would be able to see their picture. I would prefer an identity card without a picture for females. We do not allow women to go out of the house and get an education because this independence would create problems when they marry and move in with the in-laws.
But men aren't just concerned about the photograph and problems with the in-laws. Activist and researcher Farhat Parveen says an identity card is often the first step in empowering women.
One of the main reasons men don't want Pashtun women to have their identity cards is they would demand rights. The other reason is that Pashtun men don't want to give the right to vote to Pashtun women in elections, but if they would get identity cards, then they would demand this right too.
Women's rights advocates in Karachi want to increase the number of female voters in the upcoming election. Although women make up more than 50% of the population of the country, voter turnout is often low, especially in areas where women lack identity cards. Some progress is being made. According to the UN, 12 million women across the country received computerized ID cards during the last 3 years. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Karachi, I'm Catherine Comp, FSRN.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino.